Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Derek's live chat show on this gorgeous Wednesday afternoon. I've got today Simon Hazeldine, who's a fantastic friend of mine. He is also a professional speaker, author of four books, and spent the first part of his career working for Whitbread in selling, sales and selling for a large multinational like Whitbread, when it was actually a brewing company rather than a hotel group that now just owns Premier Inn and Beefeater. And Simon was telling me that his first induction was a four-week sales course, intensive, in a hotel, video cameras, non-stop, role plays, etc., etc. And if you did very much wrong, you lost your job. So it's a great pleasure to have Simon with me. And I just wanted to talk about selling just for a minute, because we're all salespeople, and a lot of people in the UK, and I guess in the States as well, and in Slovenia, think selling's a dirty word and shouldn't be done. Selling is something that everybody in every company at whatever level should be selling themselves, selling their company, selling their products, and encouraging people. And I work with charities. I do quite a lot of work with charities in my spare time, pro bono. And I noticed that a lot of people in charities don't think themselves as salespeople. Well, of course they're salespeople. They're selling the charity. And what are they trying to sell? They're trying to sell the charity so people give huge, big donations. And one charity I know really well at the moment has had to downsize by 2/3 because of the lack of income. And that is going to be the new normal. So we're all salespeople. And I want to introduce to you Simon Hazeldine, author of this particular book that I'm really interested in, NeuroSell, How to Sell Using Neuroscience. Simon, welcome to the welcome to my live web show.
Yeah, thank you, Derek. Great to be here. And yeah, absolutely endorse your comments around selling. I'm very fond of saying in business, nothing happens until somebody sells something. So, you know, it's a vitally important thing. I think the issue people have is it's been done historically. It's been done in quite a pushy kind of way that people dislike. So hence, I understand some people have reservations, but I think it's about what I would call old school selling rather than new school selling.
And when you say old school selling, what do you mean by that?
Oh yeah, well, it's a lot of sales training that takes place, or sales methodologies, were originally based on a book published in the USA, I think in about like the 1920s, The Psychology of Selling Life Insurance. And it introduced people to the concept of sort of open and closed questions, features and benefits, overcoming objections and all of that stuff. Nothing fundamentally wrong with that, but I think it was applied in a kind of a pushy, manipulative way rather than the more modern consultative approach to selling. You know, if selling is done well, it's a very, very comfortable process for everybody involved. I view it as helping people, finding out what people are interested in, problems, challenges they've got. And then if I think I can help, and I do mean if, then we maybe can then talk about how we might be able to help them. And so when it's done like that, with integrity and with your focus on the other person, it becomes a lot easier to do. And secondly, it's much more comfortable for the other person. So you're more likely to get referred, recommended, etc. But I absolutely understand the stereotype. Average man or woman in the street is not going to be taught very, very nicely about salespeople. So I absolutely understand that people have a reservation about being described as a salesperson.
I read actually somewhere that one of the highest people in the States was a car salesperson in somewhere in Illinois, Kevin's part of the world, where he never got promoted. He just sold to everybody, and he sold to all his customers. His customers were friends, they were clients, he knew everyone's birthday, etc., etc., and had a whole backup organization. Simon, I want to turn to this book. What made you write a book about neuroscience and selling?
Yeah, so I've always had an interest in psychology. I got a master's in psychology. A lot of salespeople are kind of amateur psychologists, I think, who are interested in what makes people tick. And I attended a training session to do with becoming certified in a psychometric instrument called PRISM, P-R-I-S-M, PRISM Brain Mapping, a neuroscience-based instrument. And Dr. Colin Wallace, the guy who owns PRISM, who's an expert in applied neuroscience, it was two-day certification. And I was absolutely fascinated. And all the way through day one, I was thinking, wow, I ought to, you know, think about how we apply this to sales, you know. And I was driving home on the end of day one, got stuck on the M1 motorway, and it was shut. And I literally was sat stationary for 2 hours. I just got my pad out and started just downloading from my brain the outline of a book on the neuroscience of selling. And I went the following morning and said, Colin, I'm thinking, you know, I want to write a book on selling and neuroscience. He said, well, you write it. He said, I'll give you my technical support. And that's where it came from. And it is probably the most, I've done five books now. It's probably the most difficult one I've had to do because of the rigor of making sure that the neuroscience content was accurate. And so thankfully, Colin Wallace is such a super guy that he really held my hand and helped me through that. But, you know, fundamentally, the brain is the seat of all human behavior, all human decision making. And neuroscience is a relatively new science. Only recently have things like fMRI scanning been available to allow us to see what's happening inside the brain when it's doing certain things. And I just think the more we can understand about the brain and how it works, the easier it's going to be for us to sell to the brain inside our customer's head. So I sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek talk about B2B selling, as in rather than business-to-business selling, but brain-to-brain selling. So being able to and make it what I call a brain-friendly way of selling that maximizes the comfort in the brain of the customer. And one principle I always espouse is uncomfortable brains don't buy. So the more we can maximize the feelings of comfort the brain has, the more receptive it's going to be and the more likely it is to make a decision.
Now, you talk about in the book mirror neurons, something I've always been interested in. I remember somebody telling me that if we repeat things enough times, 21 times was the last number I heard, we increase the bandwidth of those mirror neurons and we connect better with other people. They connect with us, and sometimes the sale is made unconsciously. Now, I probably got that totally wrong, but could you expand on that?
Well, there's neural pathways in the brain, which are connections between neurons that happen. So if you're learning to ride a bike, for example, and you're, you know, classic learning sort of cycle, that it's harder when it's new because the channels, the pathways between the neurons or the connections are not made as well. So the more times you do something, the more the channel becomes established, the easier it is to do. Whereas mirror neurons, now they are the topic of intense debate in neuroscience, and there are various, and they're a specialist, they're believed to be a sort of special kind of neuron, brain cell. One theory says that they're to do with being able to predict human behavior. So it's a survival orientated. And what one way of describing them is if you're watching a game of sport, of football or rugby or say hockey, for the folks in the USA, I'm a big ice hockey fan. If somebody gets a hard tackle and you feel the impact, and it's when you go like, and you sort of experience a similar form of discomfort as the person experiencing it, that's believed to be that property of the mirror neurons that are replicating inside your brain what the other person is experiencing. So obviously one theory is in primitive times, if caveman Derek is marching towards me, my mirror neurons are working out if caveman Derek's intentions are kind and positive or dangerous and threatening. So others are it facilitates learning, and the other is it helps us to empathize. So there are a number of fascinating things. So hence, very important is that maximizing that feeling of comfort, so that what's being picked up in the other person's brain is positive and helpful.
And this all happens in the first few seconds, sussing out people that are walking towards you. And that's why first impressions are so critically important. And I know I've said this three times on this show already, but if you don't get a second chance to make a first impression, I think I heard that from my pal Will Kintish, who's on the call, who's coming on very shortly to talk about networking.
Oh, great.
All these skills are things that we've got to do at the beginning, haven't we? If we get them wrong at the beginning, we blow it. Is that right, Simon?
Yeah, absolutely. I when I was talking to Dr. Colin Wallace about it, he talked about not making it any more difficult than you have to do. You don't want a steep hill to climb. So in one model, it's slightly old-fashioned model of the brain, and it's an awful oversimplification, but it is quite useful. It's the sort of three areas of the brain. They're not areas, they're all part of a unified system, but for ease of explanation, they're sort of the more primitive reptilian area of the brain, as it's described, quite primitive. Oh, you got it there, Derek. Fantastic.
Is that showing on the screen, Simon? Is that showing?
Yeah, that's showing on mine, yeah.
Is that showing on everyone's screen? I can't tell, everyone's muted, but keep going.
Yeah, you're getting nods. So you can see there the reptilian, the more primitive part of the brain, sort of located where the spine joins the base of the skull. Then you've got the emotional limbic system, where a lot of the emotional processing, and then the more sophisticated areas of the brain, the more rational part of the brain. And Colin sort of refers, he said to me that the reptilian sort of emotional brain, you can think about it like as the gremlin brain. Now, you remember, if you've seen the film Gremlins, there's two kinds of gremlins. There is the nasty reptilian one, and then there is the soft, cuddly one. And he said, you've got to get the reptilian bit to calm down. And that is all about first impressions, and it's simple things. You know, I go out sometimes on coaching visits with salespeople, and I had to say to one guy, I said, you know, do you like your job? And he said, yeah, I love my job. I said, well, you know, tell your face, you know, cause just smile. And because he was going in looking all down. Smiling is a very strong unconscious message that I'm not a threat to people. Also, proxemics, they call in body language. Don't be very respectful of personal space. Don't get too close to people too quickly. And then, well, post-COVID, let's see where we go with handshakes. But, you know, making sure your handshake is firm, not too bone crushing, no limp fish. And also a tip always is to hold if you've got a bag or a briefcase, hold it in your left hand so that your right hand is dry. So there's not that uncomfortable, moist handshake feeling, because that's going to kick off a real physical which might damage that first impression. But yeah, there's a lot of conflicting evidence about how quickly this impression happens, but it's certainly fast. It's definitely fast. And then if you've come into it badly, you've got a real steep hill to climb. I mean, yeah, it's great. You've got Will Kintish coming on, because he'll be the past master of how to manage that in networking situations with people, without a shadow of a doubt.
The thing I find really interesting is that a lot of people don't get this stuff, do they? They really don't get it. And I don't know why they don't get it. And they don't get their head around it. You know, I coach people to stop before you get there early, get into the room early, pick where you're going to stand up, sit. Yeah. I did a session on this on Monday. It's on YouTube. But and then get your handshake right and get all these things right. And then you can open the sale properly. And closing should be pretty easy, shouldn't it? If you've got a good product and they like you, because often the differential, and I don't know if this was the case in Whitbread, but the difference wasn't the beer, was it? It was the person that turned up to sell you the beer.
Well, there was certainly, when I was a sales manager, we did have the slight advantage that Stella Artois was the number one product, growing at 25% year on year. So that did make it. But it's an interesting, we had a lot of products in our range. And what I have learned, and I challenge salespeople around, is sometimes strong brands create weak salespeople, because you're just an order taker, not an order maker. Now, I've got an iPhone. Now, if when they launched the iPhone 11 Pro or whatever, and you've got 200 people queuing around the corner to buy it when the shop opens, and three of them have slept overnight in a sleeping bag, I mean, if you can't sell those 300 people a phone, you need shooting. You know, my dog could have done that. So I'd often have to challenge her, how's it gone? Yeah, yes, hold lots of Stella, Simon. Yeah, what about the rest of the range? Ah. And so, you know, you sometimes, you know, you have to sell, I think, more in a more sophisticated environment. If you've not got a strong brand behind you, it does take a little bit more work, without a shadow of a doubt.
I often wonder, from the work of Robert Cialdini, the famous psychologist on selling and marketing, but whether some of those people sleeping in Covent Garden outside the iPhone shop have been put there by Apple to make sure that everybody thinks that everyone's buying. Is that called social proof? And
social proof, social proof. Call me cynical, Derek, but I would say, I mean, again, you know, you talk about... basic stuff. And I had a boss. I was lucky to have a great boss very early on. I think it was Vince Lombardi, the American football coach, who said you've got to become brilliant at the basics. And he was really drilled me. You've got to become brilliant at the basics. And one of the basics is using testimonials and case studies when you're selling. And it's so common that people don't have it. You know, they talk about how, you know, themselves and their company. What you want to be talking about is how you've helped customers who are as similar as possible to the customer you're attempting to convince. Don't tell me how great you are. Get other people to tell you how great we are. So recommendations, referrals, testimonials, case studies, incredibly powerful. Amazon uses it extensively, and there is nothing on an Amazon web page that's not there. Unless it's proven, because they have analytics coming out their ears. So they use a social proof. They use it 3 times. Reviews, more 5-star reviews. As an author, the better you sell. 75% of people who bought this, bought this. The other 25% did this. Oh, and just before you go, 67% of people who bought NeuroCell also bought, you know, da-da-da-da, along with social proof 3 times. So
I probably bought this book, Simon, but I wasn't going to show it, Bare Knuckle Negotiating, because that's the only point where you and I are in competition, really. This is the book they probably should be promoting instead.
I would wholeheartedly recommend my book above it. No, I wholeheartedly buy both of them.
So. While we're competing, by the way, I think I've got more books on my bookshelf than you have.
I'm not sure.
Your books better than mine.
You can't see my others. It's interesting. I was running a negotiation workshop last year, and I said something like, "Oh, I've been reading this book on negotiation," and one of the guys on the program said, "Do you still read books on negotiation then?" Which was really interesting. And I said, not only do I read books on negotiation, I read every single book that's ever published on the subject. And he went, well, you can't learn very much, can you? And I was going like, really? I think I'm flattered. You think I've nothing more to learn on this topic, but that's just not an attitude that I
unbelievable, actually, isn't it? But again, only about 1% of people get that. I mean, I've got about 25 books on negotiation up there. Some of them are rubbish, I must admit. And a lot of them are written in that sort of American Donald Trump style, if I can say that, probably upsetting Kevin O'Connor from Chicago here, but which is, and in fact, I've got Donald Trump's book right in the middle of it. But
Trump style negotiation. There's actually some good stuff in there. I think it, because largely because it's written by his lawyer, so rather than Donald, who is obviously knows more about, well, everything than anyone else, I think. So surely he's an expert on negotiation as well, Derek.
Right there. Simon, we're running out of time. We've got a couple of questions in the...
Yeah.
But one last tip on selling for people listening to this and listening to the recording on YouTube.
Yeah, I'd just say, and it applies in selling and it also applies in negotiation. I think it applies in management and leadership. You've got to get out your own head and get inside the other person's head. You want to be seeing the world through their eyes. The more you get the perspective of the other person, be their prospective client or customer or member of your team or whoever, the better able you are to influence, persuade, achieve, motivate, inspire people. People spend too much time in their own head. They don't look at things from the perspective of the customer, the other party, enough.
Yeah, we notice that everywhere we go, don't we? Even in the speaking association, Simon, a lot of speakers talk about themselves rather than what they can do for the audience, which is the most critical thing of ever speaking. And that's not speaking to a big audience. That's whether you're speaking to one person one-on-one, or if you're in a charity, speaking to someone who's going to maybe write you a big check and what that would do for them, make them feel great, have a tour of the facilities, see what the charity does for the people who are receiving the benefit of it. And that's a huge sales point. So yeah, and doesn't that come from How to Win Friends and Influence People? Isn't that where?
I think that we were chatting about this, weren't we, previously? 1920s, Dale Carnegie. I mean, I know. Yeah, there we go. It's popped. Will's got it. The language is a bit dated, maybe, but the philosophy of that book, it would be in my top 10 books for salespeople, for anyone in the world of business or charity. Just if you've not read How to Win Friends and Influence People, buy it. Definitely buy it. And Robert Cialdini's book on influence, absolutely exceptional.
Thanks, Simon. I've got a few questions now coming in.
Yeah.
Godfrey Lancashire. Is it true more intelligent people make better liars, or indeed better poker players? He was a private investigator for 20 years, came on and told some fantastic stories, and he's coming earlier in May. And of course, the real question is, why do they make better liars?
I'm not necessarily certain. I know there's a connection between intelligence and ability to deceive. I do know that correctly diagnosing deceit is a particularly challenging thing to do. It's a lot of nonsense is talked about it, and it's made very, very simplistic. Some good stuff. Paul Ekman's micro expressions, is very, very interesting field of study. And I'm trying to remember the guy, Joe Navarro, I think, what everybody is saying, an FBI profiler, I think. I've certainly benefited from Navarro's work. Certainly in neuro, so we get some photos, some non-verbals of signs of discomfort and comfort that you can see that helps you to read how comfortable a customer is feeling or are potential indicators. It would be probably an interesting thing for us to do as negotiation people, Derek, was to identify what the latest sort of thinking and research was into deceit signs. I think that might be quite helpful.
I think
Godfrey's waving at you, Derek.
Godfrey, yeah, let's bring Godfrey in, the questioner. You have to unmute, Godfrey. Technical.
Yeah, got it. Okay. Thanks. Very, very quickly, Simon. I was coming from it, really, because what triggered the question was it's back to empathy. And in investigative interviews, even under caution on tape or audio, it was always important, I thought, to try and get in the mind of the person you're interviewing. So the big bully boy tactics never seemed to me to work. It was much better to stay calm and try and picture what the other person was going through.
Yeah, fascinating.
But that led us into thinking, actually, that those that were more intelligent were trying to do that to you as well. And there was this double game going on.
Yes. Yeah. Well, certainly some fascinating research if you study psychopaths, you know, their ability to charm and be very, very persuasive. And, you know, the dark triad of sociopaths, psychopath and narcissism is an interesting, that field of psychology. There's some fascinating stuff there. Slightly worrying, psychopaths do seem to have a propensity to occupy positions of leadership and authority. So, that's a consideration for us to worry about, I think, in the world of business and politics, maybe. So,
you know, that program on 9:30 on BBC on a Saturday night, they're just making a third version of it with Jodie Comer, the Liverpool actress in it. I can't remember the name.
Killing Eve.
There was an interesting article in the Telegraph the week after they reviewed the first series, saying that they thought that one in five chief executives were psychopaths.
Yeah, and I'm not
I went out and thought about that. I'm not. I think that might have been right, Simon. Or at least
yeah, I think we've got to be careful of sensationalist headlines. But apparently, there's more of them around than we all think. They're sort of Norman Bates-esque serial killers, where that's a different manifestation of it.
Thanks for that question, Godfrey. We'll get you back on to talk about some of your interview techniques, if we may, please, in a short.
Yeah.
Kevin O'Connor says, Carnegie is one of the most popular books among his 18-year-old students. That's really interesting.
That's good. I'm glad to hear it. That's fantastic. That's really, really good.
And John Lisby asks you, what are your top tips for selling while on a video call?
Just be aware that when we are face to face, we have maximum what are called social cues. So we have all the non-verbals, we have voice tonality, we have, you know, facial expressions, all that sort of stuff, which does make a big contribution to overall communication effectiveness. When we go into more virtual remote environments, a lot of those social cues drop. And I did some research for a client. They had a lot of people negotiating over telephone and via email. And on my LinkedIn profile, there's an article that sort of summarizes some of the points from the research. But basically, there's a bigger chance for misunderstanding. So we need to be asking much, much deeper questions. You've got to be very, very careful about making assumptions. So silence, for example, could be assent or dissent. Where possible, try to get people on camera so you are maximizing visual stimuli that is coming in as well. And when we have been running, and the organization I work very closely with, we've been running virtual training and seminars and speaking things for several years. It's now like on steroids at the moment, as you can imagine. But the key thing we do is interactivity. Very, very early and continuously through the session, have lots of interactivity with people. So I'd strongly, you know, recommend interactivity very, very early. That's what you should be doing face to face anyway. So what we have to remember is good selling is good selling. We're just having to adapt and compensate for what is missing, which I think are those social cues and that level of emotional connection between people that you get face to face that you don't get. So twice as much listening, twice as much clarification, twice as much listening. I think you have to concentrate and focus. I'm more tired after a 90-minute virtual, running a 90-minute virtual workshop than I am doing a 45-minute keynote speech in front of 1,000 people, and I burn a lot of adrenaline when I'm on stage keynoting. I can do a day's workshop face to face, and my energy level's almost not affected. But virtually, I'm obviously having to concentrate far more in that medium. So I think as well, you know, basic prep, but make sure you're well watered and fed and your energy level's in a good place. Maybe go outside, get some fresh air before you go on that virtual sales call to get yourself physically, mentally ready for it.
Fantastic, Simon. We're out of time now, but when you come back a second time, because you did agree to that.
I will do. Yeah, you closed me on that one, Derek.
Good closing skills. I think we would like you to talk about some high detail selling and some questioning and et cetera like that.
Sure. Yeah, be delighted.
Amazing amount of things for us all to take away there. And we'll have it on YouTube if you want to replay it, or on the Negotiators podcast. I'm particularly interested in the reptilian brain, the emotional brain, mirror neurons, widening the bandwidth, and all these things which will maximize the sale. It's not going to be possible to be average when we come out of this lockdown. The average or the not so good people are going to have real trouble surviving. Just look at the airlines. Look at the cost of flying to Spain next year is going to be through the roof when they take all the middle seats out and things like that. We really need to be aware of that. And in a week or so's time, I'm going to have a brainstorm with some of the best experts, and I hope you can join us at where we think the world will be in 2021 and what skills we will need. Simon Haseldine, thanks for joining me. Simon,
my pleasure.
if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Yeah, my website is simonhazeldine.com. It's S-I-M-O-N-H-A-Z-E-L-D-I-N-E, spelt Dine, pronounced Dean, just a family quirk. Also, happy, delighted to connect on LinkedIn as well, no problem at all, or on Twitter, etc. And my email is simon@simonhazeldine.com. Feel free to get in touch. If I can be of any help, I'd be happy to do so. We're all trying to just, I think, help each other as much as we can during these rather challenging times. So anything, if I can be of assistance, feel free.
Thank you very much, Simon. Appreciate
it. Brilliant. Guys, I'm going to turn the recording off now, but Simon and I'll stay on the line to answer any of your questions off the record.